The Capitol Committee hearing for March 18 is called to order. Members of quorum is present. Chair Franzen, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 13?
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Chair Franzen moves approval of the minutes for March 13. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, before we get started on today's agenda, I wanted to let you know that with the power sharing in place, Chair Franzen and I will be rotating gavels. Likely for me, it'll be on Tuesday, and then Chair Franzen will be gaveling in on Thursday for us so that we could continue with our bipartisan, you know, committee to do the work for the entire state of Minnesota. And then before that, I wanted to introduce our DFL committee legislative assistant, Tezen Cy Young, our DFL researcher, Jennifer Nelson, and our DFL CA committee administrator, Jenny Nash, and our vice chair, Representative Luke Frederick. And for those of you who were on the committee last biennium, you may recall that we spent the first few weeks going over some of the funding that we received from the federal government with the IIJA, the Inflation Reductions Act, and the CHIPS Act. And so today we're going to kind of hear from some of our federal partners just to talk about some of these federal funding streams and how it may or may not impact the work that we have to do. As you all may have seen in the media recently, I think we heard from the city of Bemidji that they, you know, receive a raise grant from the Department of Transportation, that now they're not going to receive that. And in one of our prior meetings, I mentioned the Duluth Aero Lift Bridge, and then in my city, the city of Minneapolis, with our Nicola Bridge that could potentially be impacted. And then after that, we'll move on to hear about the potential impact of the elimination of the tax-exempt status for municipal bonds. And then lastly, we'll move on to the debt capacity report. And with that, we'll make sure to set aside some time for you guys after each presentation to ask questions, and then we'll go from there. First up, we have Brian Wonko, the Senior Legislative Director from Budgets and Revenue State Federal Relations from the NCSL. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wonko, who is testifying here virtually. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you to Co-Chair Lee and Co-Chair Franzen for convening this hearing, and thank you to all members. NCSL always appreciates legislative engagement. It's our bread and butter, and I'm happy to be here today. I'm the Senior Legislative Director for Budgets and Revenue, and I work in NCSL's DC office on the State Federal Affairs team. NCSL represents the legislators in the states, territories, and commonwealths of the U.S., and its mission is to advance the effectiveness, independence, and integrity of legislators, you know, and this includes representing states in Washington, D.C. Today, I'll first start with a quick overview of where we are at in the federal budget process, followed by a summation of appropriations and reconciliation activity, and then talk a little bit about funding freezes, including a snapshot of IIJA. As well, I'll mention, you know, briefly our stance on bonds, municipal bonds as well. Again, first I'd like to highlight the massive collision of initiatives. There's federal budget reconciliation, funding freezes by executive orders, tax reform, and debt limit all happening at the same time with varying states in negotiation among Senate, House, RD, Congress, and the White House. All this is creating uncertainty for states. These all impact fiscal year 2026 federal funding to states, meaning this October 1st. And this is something we, you know, keep highlighting to legislatures across the nation, that this will happen quickly. For the freeze, the release of an OMB memo in January and the initial days of the new administration saw a lot of misunderstanding on implementation of the memo, and what we were told were unrelated shutdown of various portals. Causing confusion and uncertainty that led to the withdrawing of the memo. In addition, more uncertainty exists due to several lawsuits, including several being led by consortiums of state attorney generals. Meanwhile, the White House still is pushing forward its policies contained in the OM memo, even with its withdrawal, and I'll discuss that in a minute. Again, this collision of policies in the executive and Congress is unprecedented. There are many integral components that are all being integrated where in the past they have been, may have been dealt with all separately. Next, you know, briefly talk about appropriations and reconciliation. This really means tough decisions by members of Congress. For the reconciliation process, the budget resolution that was passed in the House, you know, meant that top lines are set. And the House is the preferred route by the administration, even though the Senate also, you know, passed its budget resolution, the focus is on the House. And we'll see authorizing committees where the resolution, you know, kicked instructions back to, and then as well as appropriations subcommittee chairs, you know, face tough spending choices and debate as in the next several weeks they'll, you know, start to hold their hearings within their jurisdictions. For example, the largest cuts we'll see through the reconciliation will be, and these are cuts over 10 years, are to energy and commerce of $880 billion. Where we have the most concern for Medicaid, education and workforce by $330 billion. This largely means changes to student loan repayments and types of loans and grants available, as well as to the agriculture sector by $230 billion, which largely means changes to nutrition assistance such as TANF and SNAP. I did already mention the debt ceiling. This also comes into play in the discussions and debates. House and Senate leaders must consider debt limit in the negotiations, as is a concern for fiscal-minded legislators. It was recently suspended in the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023 that suspended it for 2 years. And such a tactic may be repeated. We've heard the administration ask for a year-long repeal of the debt limit, or we've also heard talks of increasing it by $4 trillion, which would essentially put us into January 2026. But fiscal hawks may remember that the deficit still increased considerably under the fiscal under FRA, Fiscal Responsibility Act. So maybe hesitant to follow that as a repeat. Another thing that I mentioned, is federal tax legislation, expiration of the Tax Cut and Jobs Acts. For context, this was a first-term hallmark for Trump, but extensions mean offsets are required for the $1.6 trillion decrease in revenue. In the first iteration of TCJA, we had offsets elsewhere that can't be repeated. So that just means, we have to have it paid for. They got to rob Peter to pay Paul somehow, to put it bluntly. Lastly, it's time. We hear, TCJA was passed in December 2017, 11 months after Trump took office, even if it was a focus, so that still took 11 months. Here we see there are more balls in play with equal priority and more opportunities for derailment. So states may want to plan contingencies for late approval or approval late in the year, despite leaders talking about April, May, if not the end of summer. It could take a while. Again, this will impact FY26 or get very close to FY26 funding deadline of October 1st. Next, a little on the executive orders funding freezes. The OMB memo highlighted seven areas, and the focus continues there. Most notably for this committee, I would highlight Unleashing American Energy, a memo that was put out January 20th of 2025, that immediately paused disbursement of funds, through IRA and IIJA. And again, I'll mention that more in a minute, how that, is specific to IIJA, and, I have a graph, that I can share with you that should be already in your packets. These EOs, all seven of them, really were focused on the previous administration's presidential priorities, such as DEI policy and the Green New Deal. A supporting OMB memo contained 50-plus pages of programs in an Excel sheet that sought review by the new administration heads that were just, at that time, just either not even in office or, in the process of being confirmed or just newly confirmed. So, there's 1,500 plus programs, and so we kind of get a flavor of where the administration was headed in their thinking and which programs would be targeted. And that's a good place to start if you, want to compare side by side of what potential programs that, under the jurisdiction of this committee that would be impacted, by such a funding freeze. A third memo then rescinded the original memo. But again, as I mentioned, these are still priorities for the administration and they're still moving ahead with them. NCSL has been had good dialogue with the White House. We continue to urge, you know, White House and administration dialogue with states to allow time for compliance and understanding. I think that's, you know, really important. You know, in the early 8 days, we had quick engagement that identified the broad, you know, unrelated adverse impacts of the freezes, and then the you know, adverse impacts of the shutdown of the portals, you know, which helped, you know, to the White House understand, you know, the very, you know, poor position that, you know, states were in because of this, the funding freezes. And I say that because, you know, politics aside, we're hearing from legislative fiscal officers from across the country that the concerns is mostly about planning capabilities. It's hard to construct and pass budgets without knowing federal flows to states or impacts on revenue from federal tax changes. Not all states share the same concern. However, some states are more coupled to federal policy than others, and so we are hearing a lot from them. Even, you know, a shutdown of the portals, you know, caused reverberations and inability to payments, you know, for states to make payments to hospital systems, you know, fairly quick. And I use that as an example as, you know, one of the frustrations that we heard of. And later that we were told that even if, when the funding freezes did occur, you know, then were reopened and unfrozen, that the payments came haphazardly or disjointed. So again, it's less about the politics there and more just about the administration and ensuring states have the capability to continue on the programming even with, you know, changes to the funding streams. Lastly, I just mentioned a lot of, you know, of this is kind of in limbo. Court cases take time, and a lot of these court cases are ongoing. You see new court cases almost daily. You know, I already mentioned attorney generals. There's two or three right now, you know, for attorney generals. There's one on nonprofits going, you know, suing OMB. We have, you know, states against Doji, firings, late resignation. We also have cases, you know, centering on Department of Education and, you know, foreign development funds. As well as ag programs, you know, that provide local school food sourcing by local farmers and, you know, farmer investments into energy efficient operations. So I will conclude just with IIJA. Give me a second. I can share my screen. And this would be the handout that should be in your packets that says Department of Transportation. So if you guys can all see that, I just want to highlight, so, you know, this is up to date as of January 31st, 2025. The administration, probably because of the transition, hadn't provided the end of February funds. But, you know, these are IIJ funds, you know, for, you know, Federal Highway Administration and different programs. And I just want to point out to the second to last column that says percentage obligated. So that's kind of the best area to look at as far as where concern is whether something is obligated or unobligated. In the past, rescissions that took place were, you know, programs that were under target for or will be under target for reconciliation, a lot of times it's the unobligated funds. And so this would be, you know, if you look over to the sixth to last, kind of in the middle where, you know, grants announced, those are grants that are announced but not necessarily, you know, having a procurement agreement, whether that's a grant, cooperative agreement, or a contract. So it's not necessarily a done deal. And so those are the easiest funds to rescind because they still remain with the various agencies, such as Department of Transportation. Obligated, you've entered into a procurement vehicle, a contract, or a grant, and that money, you know, may not be transmitted to the, you know, to the states yet, but the federal government has a legal obligation, you know, then to send that funding. So, you know, for the IIJA, where it was mentioned as a potential funding freeze, again, you know, it'd be best to look at in the framework of the Trump's policy priorities versus what the Biden policy priorities were, and then the change from, you know, the green climate funding or Green New Deal. And so where funding that, you know, focuses on that, that, you know, is within this graph or within IIJA, which is sometimes few and far between, but I don't want to minimize the importance of those, is the best kind of understanding of what will be, you know, targeted. So, like, for example, Federal Highway Administration is, you know, nearing 80% obligation, while other, you know, areas are considerably less. So, you know, with that, again, you know, thank you. Hope this, you know, helps, you know, this, you know, broad federal understanding of where we're at in the process. Sorry, I did want to mention bonds. You know, one aspect of NCSL, you know, strives for, and we updated policy on this during our last summit over the, you know, in Louisville this past August. So it was, you know, to advocate on behalf of state and local bonds. And so there's an understanding that's being shared, you know, with other groups such as, you know, National League of Cities and National Association of Counties. State and local bonds are, you know, very important to states and especially local, you know, governments, and shouldn't be used as an offset. And this is kind of the concern where we talk about this reconciliation process. And, you know, there's $4.6 trillion in the tax cuts. You know, again, they're, you know, looking for ways to cut to offset that. But the amount of money that they'll save for bonds, you know, kind of pales in comparison to the, you know, actual benefit to states and localities where they can remain competitive because of the tax exemption status. So I know you guys will be talking a little bit more later on that, but I just wanted to echo that, you know, bonds are a critical, you know, part of our advocacy strategy to Capitol Hill, and we understand their importance. So again, thank you for the time, and, you know, happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Director. Members, do we have any questions for the Director? So, Director Wonko, I do have a question for you. You know, with regards to the spreadsheet, is there a spreadsheet that's available that talks about how much of the funding, at least, you know, with Department of Transportation to the state of Minnesota, so a state-by-state breakdown?
I did specifically look for that, and it did not. There's another area that I can check, and I can see if that provide that, you know, for you. That I wonder if a different organization might have it. So, yeah, I can look at that and see if I can, you know, get that to you later.
Sounds good. And we do have Minnesota Management Budget here, so we can ask them to. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you. Just following up within the Department of Transportation, the federal funds, because my district received a grant approval through the Biden administration for $25 million for a viaduct that's crumbling and close to 100 years old. And what was informed to me by the Department of Transportation was that they're going to be doing individual grant reviews. Do we have a timeline on potentially what those individual reviews are going to be?
Director Wonko.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, we've asked specifically the White House for such a timeline. And at the time, they didn't have it. So these, again, were, you know, early on in the conversations of how quickly these programs be unfrozen. And the response at the time was, you know, many of them may be unfrozen very quickly. Others, you know, especially those that dealt with this area or the, you know, the Biden era, you know, presidential priorities I mentioned, you know, certainly wouldn't be. But we have heard that, you know, like your project, that, you know, there has been, you know, delays, unexpected delays. And so, you know, we've raised those concerns, but, you know, unfortunately have not received timelines as far as when, you know, all these would be remedied.
Chair Franzen.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be helpful if the members have projects that also rely on federal funding, that we could get those projects from our members so that we can have one sheet that we can go to the administration with for updates.
Thank you, Chair Franzen. I think that's a good idea. And so if members, you know, on this committee or just in the House, if you guys have any projects, definitely let us know so that we could reach out to our federal partners to see if we could get a status update and then also connect with MMB and the relevant state agencies too. Thank you, Chair Franson. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chair Lee. You know, I had a conversation with the Department of Transportation yesterday in regards to this and what they had stated. If we in our district was to draft that legislation to be in a follow-up to Co-Chair Franson, is if that would be suitable to support these projects that are kind of in the limbo here that are crucial, right? We don't want bridges collapsing and we don't want viaducts falling and crumbling. And they responded that they wouldn't be able to support without the governor's approval due to the recommendations. And I'm putting that on the record here because being somebody that seen and knows folks that survived the 2008 35 bridge crumble during the Pawlenty administration, and it was stated as an equal salute on bipartisan that we won't allow these things to happen ever again in the state of Minnesota, I'm a little concerned that that was a response that the Department of Transportation told me, because I would assume that we would want safety, right, first. So I appreciate that you've offered, let's get these projects that have been frozen to get on the board collectively to see if we can get the support from the departments that are saying that there's not really a plan B happening here. Thank you. No further.
Members, any additional questions? Representative Scraba.
In my past life, Highway 169 North Task Force went through this ordeal with MnDOT. I can tell you, don't tell me what to do. We know what to do. That's the attitude. And we got $20 million from the federal government. The state just had a match, 15 years we waited for the match because they didn't want to do it when we did. People were dying on the highway. Didn't matter. This is what we do. This is the way it works. You ran into exactly what I ran into. We even tried to get a bill passed, and they said, go ahead, but unless it's earmarked specifically for that, we're not giving any of our money up for it till we think it's ready. So it's a big organization. It's a huge organization. I wish you well. If we can help, I will, you know, I know where it is. I'm familiar with your project. So I share in your frustration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scarwood. Chair Franzen.
And I'm not being political or anything, but the bridge collapse of 2008 was not a Pawlenty issue. It was an engineering design issue that there was a lawsuit brought forward. Still does not make anything correct, but it wasn't because lawmakers allowed it for it to happen. It's just it was an engineering design firm issue.
Thank you, Chair Franzen. Last piece on this, Representative Perez.
Thank you. Just to address, there's not a debate on this. I'm just saying that it happened during the 2008 when Pawlenty was our governor, and he stated that this should never happen again. So there's nothing in ways of what I was discussing to attack this administration. It was more of Minnesota going through the realization that this has happened, and it was a tragedy. Thank you.
Thank you. And just before we move on, I just want to echo Chair Franzen again. You know, for our members, I think the quote is for all of us to start gathering information from our local communities to communicate with us as their state legislators so that we know how to communicate with the federal government on their behalf so that we figure out, you know, what's going on. And I think that, you know, it's really helpful that, you know, we're having this conversation. Thank you all. Thank you, Director Wanko. Next up, we will move on to get a state update on the federal infrastructure funds from MMB. Welcome to the committee, Director Mengi and Director Corey. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Anna Mengi, Assistant Commissioner and State Budget Director at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'll turn it over to my colleague to introduce herself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leah Corey. I am the Enterprise Director for Federal Funds Implementation with MMB, and it's an honor to be here with you all. My predecessor was here about a year ago. He gave you an update on the federal funds unit and did a deep dive into many of the programs that are funded through the three pieces of legislation that our team is charged with helping to coordinate. So my objective for today is to give you all just an update on the progress that we've made as an enterprise and to give you some insight into kind of where we're focusing right now. Okay. So I'd like to start with just a little bit of background about the timeline and give you all some historical context for where we are right now. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, also known as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, was passed by Congress in November 2021, and it focuses pretty broadly on your traditional infrastructure areas. So roads, bridges, water, broadband, et cetera. It includes reauthorization of the surface transportation bill, as well as some new provisions for newer programs. And it is primarily a combination of formula and discretionary awards. In 2022, two additional pieces of legislation passed in Congress, the Inflation Reduction Act passed, and that focuses on clean energy, and it includes a combination of competitive grants, loans, and tax credits. And then the CHIPS and Science Act also passed in 2022, and that focuses on domestic semiconductor research, development, and deployment. So following the passage of these pieces of legislation, the 2023 Minnesota legislature passed a number of supportive actions to help the state of Minnesota really capitalize on these federal opportunities. I'm going to talk about a number of those and kind of where we're at with those. It would behoove me to acknowledge we're in a period of transition right now with the new administration. Our team is tracking really closely any executive actions, any agency guidance that we're receiving from federal awarding agencies, as well as congressional action. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the federal landscape because I think it's still relatively uncertain in the potential impacts on infrastructure funding in the kind of near, medium, long term. But we are tracking some disruptions. There's some emerging issues as Chair Lee, you've already noted, with in particular an award going to Bemidji and the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And our understanding with that particular award is that it is we're tracking it closely, and we're seeking alternate funding sources to continue that project and keeping it moving. But our team is really charged with kind of tracking what is happening at the federal level. So I want to spend a little bit of time just reintroducing you to our team. We were one of the investments that the 23 legislature made, and our team is charged with maximizing funds under IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS. Maximizing funds for us means bringing in the highest possible amount of funding possible in a strategic and effective way to support the state in achieving our goals. So we operationalize our charge of maximizing funds through four primary work streams. We focus on strategy development, so we are tracking what's happening at the federal landscape and really thinking about what opportunities might be good for us to pursue as a state. We support with opportunity promotion and coordinated pursuit, so we get the word out about kind of different opportunities or components of the bill that we think are really high leverage. And then support going after those. One of the areas of the IRA in particular that we are supporting is something called direct pay. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about what that is and what we're doing to support that. The third area we support is around technical assistance and tools. We know that navigating the federal funding landscape is very complicated. There's lots of terms and requirements. So part of what we see our job is to do is to kind of curate and identify good resources that can help, in particular, local units of government, nonprofits, et cetera, in navigating the federal landscape. And then lastly, we support with monitoring the federal investments that are flowing through the enterprise and report out on kind of how those are progressing. Our team is lean, as you can see from the kind of org chart that I have on the screen. There's, in addition to myself, two coordinators, an analyst, and an executive budget officer that supports the work. All right, so I'm going to tell you about the progress that we've made as an enterprise over the last year since our team was last here. I want to acknowledge that the work, you know, there is four or five of us on the team, so the work that I'm going to present really represents the work of countless agencies and, you know, external entities across the state. So we work extremely closely with transportation, commerce, admin, deed, PFA, The list goes on. They are the subject matter experts, and what we see our role as is really kind of the coordinators that bring everything together to help you all as decision makers and leaders across the state in really understanding the full scale and scope of the work that we're pursuing. So the last time that we were here, we shared that we had secured about $9 billion in awards. Since then, we have secured an additional $3 billion in funding that's going to support 1,800 discrete projects across the state. I want to say a little bit about what this $12.3 billion represents. It includes both announced and obligated funds. So we've heard a little bit about obligation, right? So an announced award means we've heard that we are a recipient, but we might not have a signed agreement yet in place. An obligated award means that both parties, the federal awarding agency, as well as the recipient, have both signed an agreement. So this 12.3 includes announced and obligated. It also includes estimated formula allocations through fiscal year 26. So there is some estimation that is included in this 12.3. We pull that data from a source called the Federal Funds Information for States, so we feel like it's a pretty reliable source in projecting what will come to us. It also does include some larger awards that are not flowing through the enterprise that are going directly to local units of government and external sources, but we don't have a way to systematically track that, so it captures some of those awards, but not all. So what you're looking at here on the screen is a breakdown of the $12.3 billion in funds and what proportion of those funds are going to various programs. So you can see the largest portion of funding is going towards roads, bridges, and other major projects. So an example of a program that falls in this area is the Infra Award. So we're getting, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to support multimodal freight highway projects that are of national and or regional significance. So the Blatnik Bridge, for example, 494, are examples of what falls in this category. The second largest proportion of funding is going to clean energy and power. So an example of a program that falls within this area would be our weatherization program. We're getting $38 million, with an M, for home energy upgrades to income-eligible homeowners and renters to help save energy and just ensure that their homes are safe. Now, this is an example of an award that we have experienced a pause in. So it was disrupted for a period of time. We did get word last week that was reactivated and turned back on, so we can draw for reimbursement for that award. All right, so the weatherization program, Infra, those are just a couple of examples of projects. This just came up a moment ago with Chair Lee's question about the list of individual projects. We do have this available. I know that it was of interest last year amongst many legislators to kind of have that list of discrete projects that are funded through IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS. So we have that available to review on our website through an interactive dashboard. You can click on a particular region of the state, and it will populate the specific projects that we're tracking that are associated with that region. So a few caveats, though, to the data that we have here. It only includes those awards that are flowing through the state enterprise. So anything that's going directly to an external source isn't included in this data set because we just don't have the capacity or the ability to track that level of nuance. So it just includes those projects. It also, I think it's important to acknowledge there's a number of projects that are funded that can't be attributed to any one region. So, for example, the Climate Pollution Reduction Grant is a $200 million grant that we received. It's going to PCA to do climate smart food work. That's not necessarily associated with any one region, so it won't necessarily show up. If you're looking at, for example, Carver County or Douglas County, it's not going to necessarily show up there. But it shows up in the statewide projects. So really what this map primarily reflects are the transportation projects that are associated with a particular region, though most of the clean water and wastewater projects that are associated with the region are also show up on here. So you can go and kind of filter around for the type of project you want to learn more about, where funding is going, or you can look at a particular region to see what funding shows up there. Okay, so many of the federal funding opportunities that I've talked about require cost sharing in the form of match. The level of match for each program really looks different based on the authorizing legislation. So some of the federal programs don't require match, and others might require up to one local or state dollar for every federal dollar. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this because it just demonstrates the interconnected relationship between state dollars and the decisions that we make at the state, and then what that might unlock at the federal level. I think it's important to note that there was a significant amount of match that was appropriated during the 23 legislative session. I'm going to just be talking about three of those programs that we're calling flexible that have allowed us to be responsive to the emerging opportunities available at the federal level. I shared this with the Senate Capital Investment Committee, and I'll share it here. I think much of this is of interest and relevant to the committee, but you know, most of these funds were appropriated through other committees. So I'm going to talk about IIJA discretionary match, which is administered by MnDOT, the State Competitiveness Fund, which is administered by Commerce, and the Forward Fund, which is administered by DEED. So the purpose of the IIJA discretionary match fund is to support entities across the state in pursuing transportation projects that are available through IIJA. So this is everything from repairing roads and bridges to public transit, to upgrading airports and passenger rail. So it's a wide variety of projects. Again, having match available is often a requirement of funding, and so making that available to local units of government alleviates pressure and allows them to be more competitive on the national scene. So as you can see here on the slide, by investing $185 million from the state, we've unlocked an additional over $1 billion. The size of the projects that are funded through this match program really range. Some are smaller, some are larger. Again, they range from upgrading a park and ride facility to doing a feasibility study to explore replacing a bridge. So the State Competitiveness Fund, which again is administered by the Department of Commerce, is similar to the IIJA discretionary fund in that it supports entities in pursuing clean energy projects that are available through IIJA and IRA. Also, like the IIJA discretionary fund, the projects range in size from relatively small to around $30,000 up to larger, around $10 million, with the average being around $1.4 million. Projects that are funded under this program must meet the state's clean energy goals. And as again, as you can see on the table, by investing nearly $17 million, we've unlocked an additional 90 in federal funds. I should say that there's a number of projects that are currently reserved that are not reflected here. We're just waiting on an obligation from the federal government in order to officially commit those dollars. And then lastly is the Forward Fund, which is likely the least directly pertinent to this committee, but important nonetheless because of its impact on just the region's economic development. So there was $400 million appropriated. About 250 of those go to support CHIPS, which again is focusing on domestic semiconductor research and development. So that's going to, you know, Polar Semiconductor out in Bloomington to help beef up their manufacturing capacity, add more jobs. And then 100 of that is focused on matching the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which is focused on bioindustrial manufacturing. And then there's 50 of that 400, which is sort of generally available to match federal funds. And again, as you can see on the table, a $224 million commitment from the state has unlocked an additional $1 billion in both federal and private funding. So you pull all this together, and for every state dollar that we've invested, we've generated nearly six additional dollars from both the federal government and the private sector. So I think this is pretty remarkable. Okay, so in the last part of my presentation here, I'd like to highlight some of the work that is ramping up here at the state. What I just shared consisted of grants, and much of that funding coming out of IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS has been awarded, though there are still some active notice of funding opportunities. So I think we're tracking around 40 open, what are called NOFOs. So those are the award opportunities that are available and kind of describe the requirements in the application process. We're tracking about 40 of those right now. But I do want to pivot to talking about direct pay. I mentioned this at the beginning of my time here. It's been a pretty big focus of our team for a couple of reasons. These are not like competitive grants. Grants are, you know, there's an application process. They're reviewed by a committee. Some get it, some don't. So unlike competitive grants, direct pay is largely uncapped, meaning if you meet the requirements, you complete the paperwork, you will receive the check. So the other reason why we're focusing on this is because they are available through the 2030s, early 2030s. So there's some runway to kind of get moving and get going. So we're focusing on that right now. So you all may be familiar with the clean energy tax credits that have been around for many years. They incentivize individuals and businesses to adopt clean energy technologies as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. There are new provisions for tax-exempt entities, so state, local governments, nonprofits, school districts, tribal nations, to take advantage of tax credits in the form of direct pay, or it's also called elective pay, which is essentially a payment that a tax-exempt entity receives for a portion of an eligible project. So essentially it works like this. You put an eligible, or you plan, an entity plans and delivers a project. That project is put into service, meaning it's operational, it's functioning. The entity completes pre-filing paperwork. They file the paperwork and they get a check. Eligible projects fall into one of four categories. So energy generation and carbon capture. So the production of electricity from eligible renewable sources like geothermal and solar. There's a manufacturing category. So this is the production of components like solar or batteries or other critical materials for clean energy. There's vehicle category, so purchasing qualifying clean vehicles and the infrastructure to support. I think this is perhaps the riskier of the four areas. We've seen that through some executive orders and language coming from federal awarding agencies. And then fuels, so the production of clean fuels like hydrogen and sustainable aviation fuels. There are additional credits that can be stacked to increase the amount of the payment that an eligible entity receives, whether it's adhering to domestic content or prevailing wage, an apprenticeship requirement. So ultimately, an entity can receive up to 60 to 70% of returned back in the form of a check. The enterprise has filed paperwork. We are waiting to get our check. So we had a number of eligible projects. We filed for direct pay. There's a manual review process underway with the IRS, but we are hopeful that we'll receive this relatively soon. So this is it's exciting, and I think we feel very, you know, good about this body of work right now. So we do have resources that are available to support entities in pursuing direct pay. We are working really closely with partners across the enterprise, so Commerce, Deed, Admin. We're also working with some national and local partners to put on different webinars and offer. We're also finalizing a scope of work to provide one-to-one tax guidance for entities as they fill out the paperwork. Our team, we are not tax experts. We are connectors, so we are happy to chat with local units of government or others that are interested in learning more about direct pay and then connect them to an appropriate resource. One thing I'd like to emphasize with direct pay is that, the project has to be put in service before you can receive a check. So the state recognizes that all entities don't have access to upfront capital to initiate a project that will ultimately result in a direct payment. So one of the tools that the state has put in place is a state green bank called the Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority. It's run out of Commerce. They've recently hired an executive director. They've established a funding and investment strategy. They have identified their investment kind of principles and standards, and they are starting to issue loans. So there's a handful of examples of loans that have already been issued on the screen. So one to a community development on the east side of St. Paul, one to a nonprofit, one of their sites in North Minneapolis, as well as working in a local developer that's working in close partnership with Minneapolis Public Schools on upgrading, installing solar and battery storage on a number of buildings. Excuse me. Okay, so before I wrap up, I mentioned that there are still open and active notice of funding opportunities. So last year we shared that we were launching an opportunity tracker that our team has built to help provide Minnesotans with insight into the various opportunities that are available. That is still live. We are updating it with the open notice of funding opportunities that are available. And you can, again, you can go in and search by entity type. So if you're a nonprofit, you can search for opportunities that in which a nonprofit might be eligible, etc. And you can find that there is a website listed directly underneath the computer icon. That is where you would go to find that. So that concludes my formal remarks, and I welcome any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Director Corey. Members, any questions? Chair Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Ms. Corey, on slide 14, it shows the state commitment and then the amount of federal funds unlocked for every dollar, $5.7 was generated. How do we determine what the operational cost and the maintenance cost are of these new projects? Is that factored in here? Is there a measure of that? So we leverage federal funds, got project XYZ, but now we still have to maintain it and operate it. Is there a measure of that on these things, or how do you look at that through your department?
Director Corey.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. Representative, that is not factored in here. It's simply just kind of aggregated total. So I think that that's, you know, certainly something for us to take back and think about as we think about the long-term maintenance of these projects.
Chair Kosnick.
Thanks. I think that's an important metric that apparently is missing here that we need to be aware of when we take on certain projects that look new and flashy. Certainly, you know, things that we need that we traditionally talk about, but when we take on new projects, there's an ongoing cost to the state, even if there is matching funds.
Director Mangy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, I wanted to just flag most of the projects that are funded through these funding streams are not state state facilities or projects. Many of them are private facilities, and clearly there are still operational costs there, but wanted to just provide that nuance as well.
Thank you. So, Director Corey, I do have a question for you. You know, going back to page 8, or just the total $12.3 billion that we have awarded, obligated, whatnot, are you able to break it down to what is the amount that's in the obligated category and what is the amount that's in the awarded category? And digging deeper, too, even like looking at the different categories that you have, are you able to break it down to that specific level?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can tell you that of the 12.3, approximately, I have this written down here, 8.5 is flowing directly to the enterprise, and it is in obligation, or that would include the funding that is both obligated and announced. Of that 8.5, 3.6 has been spent. So that gives you a little bit more of a sense. I think there's more digging we can certainly do on your question about award versus obligation, but I just wanted to share with the committee that of the 12.3, 8.5 is flowing to the state or anticipated to flow to the state now. There's about 1.5 of the 12.3 is the sort of future estimated funds that will flow through the state. And then 2.2 of the 12.3 are those larger projects that we're tracking outside of the enterprise.
Thank you. Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Climate Innovation Finance Authority, could you refresh my mind, Chair Lee, if there was state money put in first for that, or is it just federal dollars in that?
Thank you, Chair Franzen. I might have to defer to MMB on this one. So either Director Corey or Director Mangy.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, thank you for your question. There was an initial investment of, I believe, $45 million of state dollars to help stand up the MnSIFA.
Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in that seed money, the $45 million, is that ongoing funding or is that just a one-time appropriation?
Director Corey.
Gonna.
Director Mingy.
Director Mingy.
Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Franzen, the appropriation for MnSIFA was one time.
Okay, thank you.
So seeing no other questions, just quickly to Representative Scraba.
And I apologize for stepping out, Mr. Chair. Thank you. When you were using the word discrete, I think I understand why you're, because like these projects are discrete, and the definition I have of discrete is we're not supposed to talk about it.
Oh.
But I think it goes back to somewhere back here, but if you could explain it for me, thank you.
Director Corey.
Mr. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative, thank you for that question. So what I'm referring to are kind of specific projects that are sometimes that will have a program that funds a number of different projects that might be in different parts of the state. So when I said discrete, what I meant was a specific project over here and a specific project here that might, again, together comprise a program.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. That's all.
Well, thank you. And to Representative Chair Kosick's point, I do want to make note that we really appreciate the work of MMB when you're actually soliciting projects through our system for us to consider in the future. That it does ask if there's going to be any operational costs to the state, you know, when we're looking at projects from units of government and whatnot. And so we know that, you know, MMB is thinking about that too. So thank you for the work there. Next up, we'll move over to the topic or the presentation on the impact of the potential elimination of tax exempt status for municipal bonds. Members, we have a remote testifier, Managing Director Jessica Cameron Mitchell from PFM Financial Advisors LLC. Welcome to the committee, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm struggling a little bit with my text, so apologies.
Yep, please proceed. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. My name is Jessica Cameron Mitchell. I am a managing director and partner for PFM Financial Advisors, LLC. We are an SEC registered municipal advisor, which means that our core business is really advising issuers, including municipalities, states, school districts, and not-for-profits on the issuance of municipal bonds, largely to fund infrastructure. My clients are largely focused on larger issuers and state-level issuers within the state of Minnesota and nationwide. But as a firm, we represent municipal entities, school districts of all sizes across the entire country. Just brief level set on this. Municipal tax exemption for bonds is considered a subsidy provided by the federal government to state and local governments to help them finance public infrastructure. Currently, within the municipal market, there are three basic types of tax status for municipal bonds. And this is federal tax status. You also have state tax exemption. For example, the state of Minnesota provides a tax exemption from state income taxes for certain types of bonds that are sold for Minnesota issuers in the state of Minnesota. But this is kind of the federal overview, if you will. So you have governmental bonds, and those are tax exempt, meaning that income received by the investors associated with those bonds are exempt from income taxes. You also have bonds that are for specific purposes that are only subject to the alternative minimum tax. And then there are private activity bonds or bonds that are taxable. And so those may be bonds that where the issuer could be a state or a municipality, but the ultimate benefactor is a private company or corporation. Why is tax exemption considered a subsidy to municipal entities? It's because investors expect a specific rate of return on their investments. And so if an investor has to pay taxes on those returns, they're going to pass that through to the issuer themselves. We know that this is not just a theory. We know that this is fact because there are taxable bonds that are already sold within the market itself. So if we think of this on a theoretical level, what it should be is our tax-exempt rate is essentially equal to 1 minus the highest marginal tax rate, which is currently 20%, right, times the allocable taxable rate. So in this case, theoretically, the tax-exempt rate would be 80% of the taxable rate. What we find is that in reality, the actual tax-exempt ratios for that relationship between the two, it varies over time. And currently, tax-exempt rates are 60 to 80% of allocable taxable rates, which means they're lower by somewhere between 1% kind of out at the 30-year maturity on bonds, or 1.6% on the earlier maturities for bonds. And that's for a AAA rated security. The graph at the bottom of this page is kind of that expected rate of return that an investor would expect to receive. The blue line is for tax exempt bonds, and the yellow line is for taxable bonds. So if you think about this in terms of examples from actual issuances. So let's look at a couple examples from folks who sold tax-exempt and taxable bonds on the exact same day. Just to protect the innocent, I have included issuers where we served as advisor, but neither of these are within the state of Minnesota. In the example of issuer A, it's a AAA rated state, and they sold bonds competitively in August of 2023. The bonds had a 20-year final maturity, so the bonds amortized or were paid off over 20 years. Their tax-exempt true interest rate, so kind of the combined rate of return that investors were expecting to see, was a 3.68%. Their taxable true interest rate was 4.992%. So if you think about this in terms of that theoretical taxable tax exempt ratio we were talking about, if the taxable interest rate, I'm just going to round it, was 5%, the tax exempt rate should be 4%. But in this case, it was a 3.68%. And so this kind of helps illustrate how those ratios can differ over time. And in the case of issuer B, again, it's a AAA A-rated, in this case, Citi. These bonds were sold competitively in March of 2024. They also had a 20-year final term. The taxable true interest rate in this case was 4.856%, and the tax-exempt true interest rate was 3.449%. So what does this mean in kind of actual numbers? Let's look at this both in terms of how much principal gets issued or the par amount of the bonds, as well as what the difference is in the debt service that gets paid on this. And so just looking at this for $1 million worth of project costs, so you want to finance, in the case of issuer A, when they were doing $1 million of project costs, the principal that they issued on a tax-exempt basis was about $905,000. On a taxable basis, it was $1,005,000. So that's a 10% difference to the project for a taxable issuance versus a tax-exempt. Then when we look at it from a debt service perspective, and this assumes that these bonds remain outstanding until that final maturity out 20 years, the tax-exempt debt service to be paid on that $1 million is $1,365,000. On a taxable basis, it's $1,510,000. And so that's a 15% increase, essentially, or it rounds to 15% increase for a taxable rate versus the tax exempt. In the case of issuer B, their principal amount, it was $935,000 for tax exempt, $999,000 for taxable. The difference in actual principal amount was only about 6%, so it's lower. But the debt service difference is higher. On a tax exempt basis, it was about that same $1,360,000. On a taxable basis, it was $1,526,000, which means that the difference is actually about 16%. And so that means that for the same amount of project, for $1 million worth of project, you're going to pay 16% more, or issuer B will pay 16% more for their taxable series of bonds. So what does this mean? And I already explained a bit about what this means, but in addition to tax treatment, when investors determine how much they want to make or what rate of return they should be receiving for their investments, there are a variety of other factors that they look at, including security. So that is what the issuer is pledging to pay back, what sources the issuer is pledging to pay to use to pay back those bonds. So general obligation, appropriation, water or sewer revenues, the security type pledged makes a difference on the actual cost of capital, the credit rating. So the state on its general obligation credits has a AAA. Many municipalities in the state of Minnesota have a credit rating lower than that AAA. If an investor, and think of it as your personal credit rating when you go to get a mortgage, the higher the credit rating, the lower the interest rate that you're going to be charged. So again, the lower rated communities are going to be more impacted by this. The other thing is the smaller the community, because investors are also concerned about liquidity of the investment. In other words, if I want to sell this investment, I buy a bond, 5 years from now, this bond no longer fits my portfolio, or I want to buy something else, I'm going to need to sell that bond to someone else. The willingness of someone to purchase that bond from me is liquidity. And so the larger the investor, typically the more liquid the investment. And so when you have state level issuers where they have a lot of liquidity out there, I've got a bunch of other investors who hold, when I go to sell that bond, who hold that same bond or that same credit. And so it makes it easier for them to decide to purchase it. They understand it. But if it's a small community, and they only have one series of bond outstanding, and it's a smaller series of bonds, there aren't as many investors who are familiar with that credit, which makes the secondary liquidity in the market not as available. And so just to kind of, again, illustrate this for you, going back to that same 5%, 4%, if the taxable rate is 5% for a AAA-rated general obligation issuance, the tax-exempt rate theoretically should be 4%. But I'm an investor, and I'm buying something that is less liquid or has a lower-rated credit, I'm going to want a higher rate of return, which means that if I wanted a 4.5% tax-exempt rate on a taxable basis, I'm going to need 5.625%. So the impacts of this increase based upon type of issuer. There may be additional costs or lower costs depending upon the interest rate environment itself. And just to hammer this home again, the additional taxes paid by the investor will be passed through to the issuer and ultimately to the constituents. Let's think about this in terms, just for a moment, of mortgages. So if you're taking out a mortgage on a $400,000 house and the interest rate is 4%, that loosely translates to a mortgage payment of $1,900 per month. If the interest rate is 5%, that loosely translates into a mortgage payment of $2,150 per month. So we're talking an additional $250 per month for that same $400,000 house. Let's say that I have limited cash when I'm going to purchase this house, so I only have $1,900 available. Well, this means if interest rates are 5% instead of 4%, I can no longer buy a $400,000 house. I can only afford to purchase a $355,000 house. So we're talking more than 10% difference in the amount of house that I could afford for the same amount of money. And the person selling the house to me, they're not going to care whether I can afford $1,900 a month or $2,200 a month. They are going to want that same value for their house when they're selling it. So the bottom line on this is that borrowing for public infrastructure will be more expensive if municipal tax exemption is lost. This will lead to either an increasing cost for projects, which goes back to that example, if you will, of issuer A and issuer B on the prior slide, or a decreasing number of projects which can be done. Because if you are limited in the amount of funding you have available, you can afford less in the way of projects. With that, I will open it up to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Director Cameron Mitchell, for that presentation. Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you again, Director Cameron Mitchell. We'll make sure to have your contact information available if members do want to reach offline to you. Thank you again for presenting. And transitioning over, we're going to have Commissioner Ho from the Minnesota. Actually, I'm sorry, before Commissioner Ho, the Assistant Commissioner of MNB, Jen Hassimer, to come and talk about this impact to the state of Minnesota. And then we'll transition on to the housing impact. Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I am Jen Hassimer. I'm an assistant commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I will just share a few brief comments with you here on MNB's perspective on the federal proposal to eliminate the federal tax exemption of municipal bonds that you just heard about. This proposal is being considered as part of the larger package at the federal level on how to fund the possible extension of the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. As you just heard from PFM, tax-exempt bonds are a tool for both state and local governments to finance their infrastructure needs. While the investors that own these bonds do not need to pay federal income tax on their earnings, the state and local government issuers benefit by receiving the lower interest rates on their debt. While eliminating the federal tax exemption of municipal bonds would raise federal revenues, it would be a great cost to state and local governments. We would lose a valuable financing instrument that helps fund vital infrastructure across all of our communities. When the legislature authorizes a bonding bill, MMB sells those bonds on a tax-exempt basis in order to realize the lowest borrowing cost for the state. So you can see that the legislature has repeatedly used this financing tool over many decades to help build and improve key infrastructure, from roads and bridges, wastewater and drinking water treatment facilities, parks and trails, ports, higher education facilities, state agency buildings, and countless community projects to improve our quality of life and help spur economic development throughout the state. The cost of borrowing for the state's bonding bills would dramatically increase if this proposal is enacted in an era of already constrained resources. But the elimination of this benefit will not only impact state government, local governments across the state will be similarly impacted, and every level of government will find it more costly to finance these important projects. Tax-exempt bonds have helped finance projects at low borrowing costs for decades. With Minnesota's AAA ratings, we were able to raise over $1.3 billion last summer at interest rates around 3.2%. We locked in those low interest rates for a 20-year period with the ability to refinance after 10 years for interest rate savings. As you heard, there's different proposals about the increase in interest rates we might face, but we would estimate that the interest rates on state bonds could increase by 1.5% or more if this federal tax exemption was eliminated. Additionally, we would lose our ability to refinance existing debt because that is a unique feature of the tax-exempt market. In terms of the state's current debt portfolio, there's approximately $2.5 billion in previously authorized debt that has not yet been sold. If this federal proposal passes, then that previously authorized debt will become more expensive, and that will have a direct impact on the state's general fund and trunk highway fund. The effects of the federal proposal, if enacted, would be borne by Minnesota taxpayers as borrowing costs would increase, and will be felt by communities, including state agencies, who cannot move their needed projects forward due to funding constraints. But we are hopeful that the many voices advocating Congress to preserve the tax exemption of municipal bonds will prevail, and we are watching the developments on this front closely. We'll be happy to keep the committee informed of any developments on this front as they impact the jurisdiction of this committee and potential impacts to the state. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions for Commissioner Hassler? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we have Commissioner Ho from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and then after that, we'll have Director Walter from the Public Facilities Authority. Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, my name is Jennifer Ho. I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. We run the state's housing bank. I think these are the key things that I want you to know. In 2017, when the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was being developed, there was a proposal to eliminate the tax exemption on private activity bonds. Ultimately, this wasn't included in the bill, but it stopped housing development in its tracks while it was being debated. Municipal bonds are in the top 15 of all federal tax expenditures. So as the Congress is looking at how it's going to pay for what it wants to do, it's definitely on the table. My team and I were out in Washington, D.C. last week, and last month also enjoyed a visit with Congressman Emmer. We believe that we are well positioned going into this debate, but everything is on the table. But we were out there really making sure that our whole delegation was aware of the importance of tax exemption for private activity bonds to the work that we do at Minnesota Housing and the work that we do in Minnesota. To just translate what previous folks were talking about, I mean, what this allows us to do is to help people with mortgages who are first-time homebuyers. And over the course of the last 10 years, we've helped 40,000 Minnesotans buy homes, and we're able to offer a product because of our ability to issue tax-exempt private activity bonds. My trade association, so the MEAs of all the other states, this is our top priority as we work at the U.S. Capitol right now in order to elevate the importance of this in the eyes of our delegation, and was happy to be able to sit down with many of them or their staff last week. Just as a sense of measure, we issued about over $500 million in tax-exempt housing bonds for the single-family and the multifamily housing market. And that makes us about 23rd in the nation in terms of ranking. I think those are really the most important pieces, is that preserving the ability to get the better financing option by doing tax-exempt private activity bonds is really critical to our being able to support both the single-family and the multifamily housing ecosystem across the state. That's the shorthand version in the interest of time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions for the commissioner? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner Ho, for coming before us.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have the new Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And likewise, I'm going to try to keep my presentation short to explain what the impact would be on the financing that we give to local communities throughout the state to support their safe drinking water and clean wastewater infrastructure. During this, and I'm going to focus on what we funded so far this year and what the projected impact would be on those communities. So we funded $226 million in 46 projects this year. That's loans only. Some of those would have included grants also. But with the benefit of tax exemption and also the MPFA discounts provided to our borrowers, so we give our loans out at significantly below market rate interest to provide savings to the local taxpayers. But even with that, if our bonds and the bonds to the communities had to be issued as taxable rather than tax exempt, we estimate that instead of them paying $53.4 million without that tax exempt benefit, they would have paid $81.8 million, a difference of $28.4 million, a 50% increase. And some of that may sound a little bit higher than what Ms. Jessica Mitchell had presented before, but a lot of our loans are 30% this or 30 years this year too, and that increases the benefit to them if they're borrowing over the 30 years. So I don't know if you have my handout, but I've got a list of the 43 borrowers that we've made loans to so far this year. And you can see for each of those what the details on those loans were, the term of the loan, the rate that we gave them. I'm showing the borrower savings that they received through going with our program, and that is significant. And then the final columns show what the estimated total interest paid on their loans would be with and without the tax-exempt benefit. And you can again see it's a significant increase to them. It would also be a burden to us because MPFA does issue tax-exempt bonds in the marketplace to help fund capital to make our loans for our revolving loan funds. We get federal capitalization grants from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We get state matching appropriations of generally 20% of the state match. But then in addition to that, we sell revenue bonds to give us additional funds to make loans. Those revenue bonds, by the way, are backed only by the assets and revenues of our funds, not backed by the state general fund or taxpayers at all. And then on the third page of the handout, I've got a summary of that activity this fiscal year to date by region throughout the state. And it shows both the count of loans that we've made, the dollar amount of loans, the savings that those loans got through funding with us, and then the additional tax benefit that they got by being able to issue their debt as tax exempt. And with that, I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Director. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, I just want to say thank you, and thank you for this detailed breakout of the different impacts for projects that are currently in the pipeline in the different regions across the state. Thank you, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you all to the testifiers who came and present on this topic. There is a lot for all of us to think about, members, as we work through trying to put in a capital budget together. Now we'll move on to our last presentation of the day, the latest debt capacity report, which will tell the maximum size of a bonding bill within our debt measurement guidelines. Welcome back, Commissioner Hassamer. Please identify yourself again and proceed.
Great. Thank you again, Mr. Chair. And again, I am Jen Hassamer, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. So I will walk you through the February debt capacity forecast, including an overview of the state's capital investment guidelines. Before I get started, what I wanted to show you quick was a snapshot of the municipal bond market and interest rates over the last 5 years. What you can see on this chart is that since the historic interest rate lows from about 2020 and 2021, interest rates have risen quite a bit since early 2022 and remain at those elevated levels. You can also see there's more periods of volatility now that we are seeing in the municipal bond market. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, when MMB sold bonds last summer, we received interest rates of about 3.2 and 3.3%. And the February forecast that I'll walk you through in a few slides here predicted and is predicting that these bond rates will continue to rise over the forecast horizon. Although the state is always subject to market conditions at any time we issue new debt, the state's strong credit rating of three AAAs, which is the highest possible credit rating, helps mitigate against these higher interest rates by keeping the state's borrowing costs low. I'll walk you through the state's current capital investment guidelines, and to start is just a reminder about why the state has these guidelines. We have had various forms of capital investment guidelines in place going back to 1979, and these are a tool for decision makers as you help to work on formulating future capital budget packages. They help designate policy limits and show a commitment to good financial planning in the state. The state's current guidelines were put into place in 2009, and I'll walk through the details in a few slides. But as an overview, our current guidelines are consistent with how the rating agencies are rating the state's debt portfolio. They include all of the tax-supported debt that is issued and authorized by the legislature, and they are a good tool for demonstrating the state's financial management and practices in this regard. The rating agencies do view adherence to our guidelines as a good fiscal management and good governance posture. And again, all of our ratings were reaffirmed as AAA just last summer. The types of debt that are captured in our debt guidelines are the ones listed on this slide. It's all of our general obligation bond debt, including general fund supported and trunk highway fund supported, state appropriation bonds, other agency bonds that are backed by standing appropriations from the general fund, like housing infrastructure bonds, as well as lease purchase financings for real estate and equipment, as well as moral obligations. But the one type of debt that isn't picked up in our guidelines are revenue bonds, and those are self-supporting debt that are paid back through a dedicated fee or a dedicated revenue stream. I'll walk through each of the guidelines in turn here. And first, our guideline number one looks at the total amount of debt that the state has sold and is obligated to repay and compares that to the state's personal income. with the limit being 3.25% of state personal income. What you can see on this slide, in our February debt capacity forecast, the state, under guideline number one, our total outstanding debt was just 1.90% of state personal income. The purpose of this guideline is to measure the state's capacity to repay debt. Personal income is not the state budget, but it is a proxy for the resource base that is available in the state to repay investors. The types of debt that we are measuring under guideline number one are listed at the bottom of this slide. It includes all of our general obligation debt, both general fund supported and trunk highway fund, state appropriation bonds, including certificates of participation for real estate, which are just a form of state appropriation debt, and the state supported debt that I mentioned. Guideline number two, it's a similar metric, but it dials out and takes a broader view and starts to layer in debt that the legislature has authorized but has not yet been sold. So again, this guideline is looking at the total amount of authorized state debt compared to state personal income, but it's measuring debt that's been sold as well as the debt that has not yet been sold. The limit under guideline number two is that all of that debt should be 6% or less of state personal income. And what you can see in February, under guideline number two, we were measuring at 3.59%. Guideline number three is a different measure within our debt capacity guidelines, and it measures how quickly the state is scheduled to repay our general obligation debt, with no less than 40% being paid off within 5 years and no less than 70% being paid off within 10 years. To be in compliance with these guidelines, we want to be at or above those designated levels. And you can see on the slide here that in February, the state has, of the state's outstanding general obligation bonds, 42% were scheduled to mature in 5 years and 73% in 10 years. The purpose behind this guideline is to realize the cost of bonding bills quickly and to pay off that debt, which helps preserve additional borrowing capacity for future legislatures. This next slide is just a quick graph showing, focusing just on guidelines one and two, which again is net tax-supported debt compared to personal income. And it just shows that the state has maintained compliance with those two guidelines over this 10-year look back on the slide. I'll start pivoting to debt capacity, and to kick it off, you should have received in your packets for today a copy of the February debt capacity forecast. That is a report we publish and provide to the legislature in conjunction with each state and budget and economic forecast every November and February. And in that report, you'll find lots of different information, including a statement of the state's current indebtedness, what our debt service costs are on that debt, as well as our future borrowing capacity. The table on this slide is just a snapshot of the state's current outstanding debt and current authorized debt at the time of publication. You can see in the principal outstanding column that there is currently about $8.4 billion in outstanding debt. The vast majority of that is general obligation bonds, the top two lines on this table, the trunk highway bonds being GO debt as well, and then about $1.5 billion in outstanding annual appropriation debt. The column on the far right shows debt that has been already authorized by the legislature but has not yet been sold. So that is debt that we are planning to sell in the coming years. And you can see there is about $2.5 billion of previously authorized debt but unissued at this time. Of that $2.5 billion, you can also see that that is mostly all general obligation bonds as well, split roughly 50-50 between general fund supported and trunk highway fund supported. As a quick reminder, when the legislature passes a bonding bill, the state does not sell all of that authorized debt at once. Instead, we typically sell those bonds over a roughly five-year horizon to meet the cash flow needs of the project so that we're matching up when we sell the bonds with when the proceeds will actually be needed. When we report and give you our measurements under our debt capacity guidelines, those are just a point-in-time calculation. And as a quick reminder as well, when debt is first authorized, it will first show up in our measures under guideline number two, total authorized debt. And then as the bonds are sold, then it will also be picked up in our measure under guideline number one. But when we start to pivot and talk about debt capacity, those are conversations around how big could a bonding bill be this year and in the future. As a reminder, the state forecast carries assumptions about future capital budgets, and the practice that's been in place in that regard for a long time is to assume future capital budgets based on a 10-year average of previously enacted bonding bills. In the February forecast, our 10-year averages were $1.01 billion in even years, the traditional large bonding year, and $165 million in odd years. But because there was no bonding bill in 2024, there was an adjustment to these assumptions for the 2025 session. Instead of the $165 million that had previously been assumed for 2025, the amount is now assumed at $700 million, which is a reduction from the November forecast if you were tracking the trends over time, and was a reduction of $90 million to get to the $700 million that's in our forecast now. The next two slides I'll walk you through are some tables that we publish in our debt capacity forecast that are an attempt to show to the legislature what the maximum amount of debt that could be authorized under each of our guidelines. The first table here on this slide is just looking at guidelines number one and number two, so the measure of total debt compared to state personal income. And the purpose behind the exercise in this table is to try to maximize the amount of debt that could be authorized that brings the state up to the limits either in guideline number one or guideline number two. So the top line on the table are the assumptions that are carried in the current budget forecast. And the second line shows the maximums that could be authorized under this personal income measure under these two metrics. What you can see that on the impact to guideline number one line, we would project that the state would reach the limit under guideline number one, the 3.25% out in fiscal year 2031. However, always need to caveat this table and those maximums you see that this is not a recommendation about the total amount of debt that could or should be authorized. And it also doesn't factor into the budget decision-making process and the additional costs that would come with those higher authorizations. So at the bottom line on this table, we show you what the additional cost would be for those maximum amounts. And you can see that within 4 years, about $600 million more in annual debt service costs would be impacting the budget. And then within the six-year time frame on the table, almost $1 billion in additional costs at these borrowing levels. The next table focuses on guideline number three, which again is how quickly the state is scheduled to repay our general obligation debt. And a reminder that the purpose behind this guideline is to help preserve borrowing capacity for the future. This guideline is only looking at general obligation debt. And what you can see in the table here, the middle column, the one with the box drawn around it, shows what the maximum amounts of bonding could be under this guideline to ensure ongoing compliance with those limits. The last two columns on the right show what the impact on the 40% test and 70% test would be under those maximums in that middle column. Fiscal year 25 is locked in place. We've already sold bonds in fiscal 25. We will not be selling anything more until this summer again, which will be the next fiscal year. So the percentages for fiscal year 25 on the top row are actually set and will not change anymore. The first time we'll update those percentages will be with our next November forecast after we sell more debt, so fiscal year 26. You can see under these maximums that we would project to stay in compliance with guideline number three. And for the first 3 years on this table, you can see that the maximum amounts are actually set at the levels assumed in the forecast already, and that once you get to fiscal 28 and beyond, there is some additional borrowing capacity under this guideline. Because there's been a lot of conversations around guideline number three, I just wanted to quickly highlight what some of the driving impacts are and inputs into our analysis that I just walked you through. Our starting place is always the existing debt that the state has already sold. So we know what our repayment schedule is. We know what our repayment amounts are on that debt. And then we layer in the debt that the legislature has authorized, but we have not yet sold. So that would be the $2.5 billion I highlighted for you on the previous slide. And we have future bond sale assumptions for that amount of debt. And then on top of that, we also layer in those future bonding assumptions that are assumed in our forecast and what the projected bond sales would be in that regard. These inputs, because we have not yet sold the bonds, it is all very dependent on market conditions and on some other sensitivities within the analysis. What you can see even from the change from the November forecast, this analysis is sensitive to future interest rate changes. From November to February, our projected interest rates have increased quite a bit within our forecast. That has had some impact. That is the main driving impact that reduced the 2025 assumption in our forecast. But because we're also depending on state agencies to give us updated cash flow estimates as to when they think they will need to spend the bond proceeds, this analysis is also sensitive to the cash flow, the spending timeline of all of the projects that have been authorized. If those accelerate or decelerate, that will also have an impact on this analysis. The Constitution limits general obligation debt to a maximum 20-year term, and when MMB sells this debt, we sell it with level principal, and that helps us repay it all very quickly and stay in compliance with this guideline. So my last slide for you here, this is just a chart that is a 50-state view looking pulled from a Moody's report that they publish every year. And this chart here is focused on what is essentially our guideline number one, which is total outstanding debt compared to state personal income. And what you can see is of the 50 states, the median measure here is about 2.0% under Moody's methodology. And Minnesota is that light green bar right in the middle of all 50 states, just a little bit above the state's median, and we are measuring at 2.1% of state personal income. So that concludes my prepared remarks for you today, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Hassemer. Seeing no questions, Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair and Director. On page 12, we have principal outstanding and authorized unissued. What happens if it's not issued? What happens to the money when it's not issued? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Hassemer.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Scraba, that represents money that has actually been committed to projects already. So if MMB were not to sell the debt that's been authorized by the legislature, then eventually we would run out of cash to pay for the invoices that those projects need to pay their contractors.
Representative Scraba.
That's fine. I'll go offline. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Next on the agenda, we will have our fiscal analyst, Mr. Andrew Lee, who covers also capital investment and transportation finance and policy, to tell us about previous trunk highway bonds authorizations and how they're impacting the third debt managed guideline. Welcome, Mr. Lee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. In your packets, you should have a one-page sheet that looks like this. So I was asked to prepare a summary of recent trunk highway bond authorizations and GO various purpose authorizations and how they interact with the third debt management guideline. So on this spreadsheet, you can see the first few lines starting in 2017 through 2024 are trunk highway bond authorizations. And unlike GO bonding bills, trunk highway bond authorizations in the past have tended to be pushed out in several years. Typically, there's a four-year window between the authorization of bonds and when the bonds have to be encumbered to a project or under contract in some way. Otherwise, the project risks cancellation. There's a few exceptions to this, in that the legislature can extend an authorization, or if a project is under construction and like cash flow is going out, but not all is needed in that last fourth year, it can be extended out. Basically, the project just needs to be underway for it not to hit that four-year cancellation window. So the boxes you see here, looking at the 2017 as an example, where just under $1 billion was authorized in trunk highway bonding. And then in tranches, starting in 2018, there's $150 million. And then you can see another $150 million in 2019, then larger amounts in 2020 and 2021. So, and then if you look at the percentage remaining, so only 0.5% of that initial 2017 authorization is still left to be sold. Then you can see in 2018 a similar four tranche authorization of $418 million. But unlike the 2017 trunk highway bond authorization, there still is $57 million left unsold from those that authorization. Part of what was unique about the 2018 trunk highway bond authorization was that it was additional corridors of commerce, which is a transportation program for trunk highway that is specific to increasing trunk highway capacity. There was a few projects selected, one particular large project, 94 and Trunk Highway 252 in the North Twin Cities Metro is one of those selected in that tranche of Corridors of Commerce funding is still in the design and sort of scoping phase. And you can see no trunk highway bonding authorization in 2019. And then starting in 2020, 2021, 2023, and 2024, there's a number of trunk highway bond authorizations, of which most of those authorizations are still yet to be sold and pushed out several years. So when MMB calculates the third debt management guideline, they're looking at a point in time and also looking out into the future. And so that dotted line down the spreadsheet in fiscal 2025 is sort of where the current calculation is around. So you can see, unlike in previous years, there's a lot of trunk highway bond authorization that has been pushed out into the future and that is still remaining to be sold. And so that factors into third debt management guideline capacity restraint. And then kind of as a comparison, on the bottom part of the spreadsheet, you can see the four-year window for GO various purpose bonds. That's the bonding bill that this committee typically does. And so you can see the 2017, just over $1 billion authorization, only about 1% of that is remaining. 2018, only about 3%. 2019, about 1%. 2020, about 16%. And then 2023, most recent bill, just under 60% is remaining. But of the window between 2024 and 2027, overall, there's about 48% of trunk highway bond authorization yet unsold, and just about a quarter of GO various purpose unsold. And I should note there's a few authorizations from past years that are pretty small amounts that I didn't include in this chart. Then if you go to the back of the spreadsheet, there's a bar chart that just shows this in another kind of a visual example of the past authorizations for trunk highway bonds. So you can see a very large one in 2008 that was associated with legislation after the I-35W bridge collapse. That was about a $1.8 billion trunk highway bond authorization. That's all been sold. And then you can see the cross hatching there is the most recent bond sale. So of the trunk highway bonds that have been authorized in the last year's bond sale, those are the amounts that were sold. And then the dark shaded amount is the remaining authorization. That's kind of a visualization of past trunk highway bond authorization.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Members, we have 2 minutes left, so any quick questions? Representative Scriba.
Thank you. So on 2018, you have, are the bonds sold or are they issued? And issued is that spent is when it's issued. Okay. And then why are they not sold if they're not? Go ahead.
Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Chair and Representative Scriba, sorry, the terminology kind of is interchangeable. Sold or issued are the same thing. Authorized is when the legislature passes the bill. Why are they unsold for 2018? I think that there's the projects are still being scoped. And thinking one particular one, the Highway 252 one.
Representative Scarver, last follow-up.
Thank you. So when the project was sold from us, and when we gave the money from the legislature 2018, the price of the project today is far, far, far more than in 2018. How do we make up the difference? Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Lee.
So Representative Scraba, unlike the GEO bill where there's a dollar amount attached to the project, the trunk highway bond authorizations, though there have been earmarks for big programs like corridors of commerce, it's just a grant to the agency to do as whatever projects they can do. So it's not like there was a specific earmark for this one project. It's that the agency was still scoping out what projects they would do.
One last question, Chair Kosnick.
Thanks. You just read my eyes. I didn't even have to ask. I appreciate this a ton as I'm learning about bonding and also helping manage transportation. But I just had a conversation in the hallway earlier this morning with the person who claims that they pretty much wrote these guidelines. And they're just guidelines. And I appreciate that we go over it, and we'll be talking about it a little bit more probably in this committee, but also transportation. That when we kind of do earmarks and have projects that aren't even ready, but we authorize it, that creates problems, and we hadn't bumped up against that yet to the guidelines. But it's an important conversation to continue to have because I think it's holding up projects that are more shovel-ready and a good case for maybe not doing earmarks in transportation for projects just because they have political capital but aren't quite ready to be done. So thank you for bringing this up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. I really appreciate your remarks, and I think that it is an ongoing conversation. I know that the Senate has been having some conversation over there regarding the third guideline, too, and so just know that for members, if you do want to have more in-depth conversation, definitely Chair Frenson and I would like to see how we could do or what can we do to increase our debt capacity so that we could really, you know, address some of the issues that's, you know, urgent right now. And so with that, members, we don't have any more business in front of us. Chair Frenson will have the gavel on Thursday. The meeting is adjourned.